Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries, and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75, 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And so you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. And that's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
So I can't
This week's book review is on Joining the New Rich, Living Anywhere, and Escaping the 9-to-5. This week we got The 4-Hour Workweek. What's up, guys? Clark from ClarkDanger.com. Super stoked on this one. The book review that we're going to be talking about. Huge impact in my life, The 4-Hour Workweek. Without this book, I don't think I would have traveled to Hawaii or Southeast Asia and had the time of my life. I didn't think it was possible. And this was the book I read first that really showed me that it was possible, that you can work and travel the world at the same time, even if you're in college, even if you have other commitments, X, Y, and Z. You know, it's written by a guy named Tim Ferriss, who I happen to really resonate with. He's probably one of my biggest mentors out there. Learned a lot from him. Controversial figure. Some people love him, some people hate him. But whether you do or don't, we're going to explore The 4-Hour Workweek, one of my favorite books. Let's go over the 10 best ideas from it right now. So starting off, what this book is about is escaping the 9-to-5, live anywhere, and join the new rich. Basically saying that in our society, the plan is get educated the first 20 years of your life, work the next 40 years of your life, and then retire and live the good life for the next 20 years, right? And that's kind of the deferred life plan. So you work really hard right now for some later date that we can kick back, relax, and really live once we have the money. And in this book, Tim argues that why wait? What's the holy grail at the end of our life justifying wasting our energy, our youth, our excitement right here and now that we're putting off? And I like to think of it as this. This is the first point, is viewing the three currencies of life. You have three stages of life right here. You're young, you're an adult, and you're old. Now, the three currencies of your life are time, energy, and money. At any stage in life, you probably really only have two. When you're young, you don't have any money, but you got a lot of time and a lot of energy. When you're an adult, you don't have any time because you're working, but you got a lot of energy and a lot of money. Then when you're old, you have a lot of money and a lot of time, but not much energy. So how do you make the most out of all three of those stages? You start valuing currencies beyond just money. And so this book really opened my eyes to traveling, to starting a business, to going for it in my 20s. And that's the main reason I like this book, valuing other currencies beyond just money. The next point is the new rich. This is a thing Tim talks about a lot in this book, that the new rich value things based on a freedom multiplier. These all start with W, and the more W's you control, the more free you are. Okay, the W's are what you do, where you do it, when you do it, and with whom you do it with. Is that? Yeah, what, when, whom, where. Okay, and so all the amount of W's you control means how free you are. So if you control all of those W's, you don't report to anybody. And that's what the new rich wants. And again, rather this book doesn't mean you have to quit your job, guys, or it doesn't mean you have to start a business, or it doesn't mean you have to walk out on your family so you can control all those W's. That's not what it's saying. It's just exploring alternative paths beyond just the standard narrative of 20 years education, 40 years working, and 20 years retirement. So how do you join the new rich? How do you live anywhere and escape the 9-to-5? Well, in the book, it goes over an acronym to do so. And the acronym is DEAL, D-E-A-L. It stands for Definition, Elimination, Automation, and Liberation. And if you do all those, then you can join the new rich, escape the 9-to-5, and live anywhere. So let's walk through them real quick. Definition. Basically saying, what do you want? If everything turned out the way you want it, you had all the time, all the money in the world, what would you do? What is your dream? What do you want to travel? Do you want to work anywhere? Basically replacing the self-limiting beliefs, getting out of your own head and getting it on paper in your journal or however you want to do it, define what you want, okay? Second step is eliminate. And we'll get into this in another point. It's basically saying there's only so much time we have. And if we try and do everything, it's like trying to eat a steak in one bite. We got to take little bite-sized chunks and avoid the unimportant and eventually get to where we want to go. This elimination is eliminating things that are unimportant. Basically, if you're complaining about not having enough time, but you're checking email 50 times a day or on social media for 2 hours, we got to realize that if we cut out the email and social media, there's 5 hours right there that we've reclaimed, okay? So elimination, eliminating things, basically simplifying down your life. Automation, this is learning to put cash flow on autopilot. So elimination frees up your time. Automation frees up your money. Not to get too into it, there's a lot of examples in the book on how to make passive income, which I know is a hot topic right now. Some people say it's a scam. Some people say it's not possible. Others that are doing it say it's the only way to become rich. So passive income is basically automation. And then L is liberation. And this is basically focusing on freeing up your location, where you do everything from. So working remotely or on an internet-based business that you start. Location can be traveling as well. So location. All right, the fourth biggest point, now that we've kind of set the book up, let's start getting into the content of it. The big point that I got was that having all the time in the world, that fantasy that you and I both have, if we didn't have to work at all, well, that's not really the end goal. Because we'd get so bored sipping pina coladas on the beach, right? There's only so many you can sip before you want to work. And I've gone over this, that we have that triangle of work, rest, and play. And then all those three need to be aligned in order for us to really feel like we're doing a good job in life. And that if we just have all the time in the world, that's not what we really want. Because that's like having all the play in the world and all the rest in the world. You need a certain amount of work to keep you happy. And you need a certain amount of rest. You need a certain amount of play. You need all three of those things. So removing the fantasy from my mind of, well, I just want all the time in the world so I can just do X, Y, and Z was really gratifying because I realized how much I can enjoy work if I'm doing the right kind. All right, the fifth big point is why retirement sucks. This is a great little bit in here. Everyone thinks retirement's the best years of your life, but Tim kind of argues the opposite. He says that retirement's bad for three reasons. The first is that it assumes you hate what you do, right? If you want to retire, if you think it's going to be great, well, what are you running from? What's the job that you don't want to, that you want to escape from so you can no longer do it, right? So that's the first one. The second one is that the cost of living keeps increasing and our retirement really doesn't. Unless it's invested, unless it's making interest. I mean, inflation is what, like 3% a year or something like that? So if you retire for 20 years, you know, it might not seem like a lot at first, but over time, our money is going to start shrinking. And the third one is that if you're someone who can retire 20 years before you die or at 60 or 65 or whatever, chances are you had a good enough work ethic and you were self-motivated, self-starting, that when you get to retirement, you're going to be so bored by week three, you're going to want to go back to work. So those are kind of three really cool points about why retirement's not necessarily the goal. All right, the next point is a quote from the book I really liked. It says, a person's success or failure is determined by the amount of uncomfortable conversations he or she is willing to have. I love this because it's talking about that our success in life is determined by how willing we are to get uncomfortable. That's talking about, you know, with uncomfortable conversations with your job, like negotiating a salary is plus or minus. But I think it goes deeper with getting uncomfortable, getting out of your comfort zone. Things that are uncomfortable, let's look at them. Traveling, unfamiliar places, that's uncomfortable. Living in a new location, that's uncomfortable. Starting a new job, dating and being in a relationship at first, that's uncomfortable. But also look at what's rewarding. Those four things can push you to become better, can get you out of your comfort zone, which is so cliche, but so true, and make you grow as a person. It forces you to grow. And so the more willing we are to step outside of the box, step outside of our comfort zone, to try new experiences, I think the more we can develop and the more we can grow. So that's why our success or failure is kind of determined by how willing we are to get uncomfortable. The next point is traveling on the cheap. I went to Southeast Asia because I read when I was 18 in this book, I was 22 when I went to Southeast Asia, but I read that you could live like a king for $500 a month in Thailand or something along the lines. I just implanted that in my mind. And 4 years later, I was doing it. And I didn't realize how cheap everything else was. Of course, this is coming from America to wherever. I'm not sure where you're watching this from. But realizing that, you know, travel doesn't have to be thousands and gazillions of dollars. It can be cheaper than where you're currently living. You know, in Seattle, a one bedroom can go for $1,100 a month. In Thailand, I knew three guys that liked it so much over there when we were backpacking, they decided they were renting a house. And the whole house cost, all three of them together, I think it was $500 or $600. They offered me a room in it, and I was like, man, I gotta get on the road. I don't know if I'm planning on staying in Thailand for four extra months. But they were just having a good time and living over there for like a couple hundred bucks. Three guys pitched together, got a house. And so we work to pay our rent, right? Then that's something we have to do. But if you're young right now watching this, I mean, you could work, save up enough money washing dishes and go ride a motorcycle through China. I mean, it doesn't really matter what job you do. As long as you save some amount of money and go somewhere cheaper, you can live pretty good. Rolf Potts was talking on here about Vagabonding, his book, which is actually part of the 4-Hour Workweek kind of reading list. So if you want to watch that interview right there with Rolf Potts, really good stuff on what we've been talking about. The next big idea is less is not laziness. So doing more is not always better. And this is something we know, but it's harder to practice, that the consistency is better than the intensity, right? So example, look at the gym. We think that doing less is lazy, right? That if you do an hour and a half long workout, you're less lazy than the person who goes in there for 20 minutes. I don't know if that's necessarily true. I mean, you get this exercise stimulus in the first 20 minutes that gives you arguably 80% of the benefit, depending on what you're doing and how long and how intensity, right? So if, in other words, if you did 20 minutes a day for 5 days a week, that's way better than doing one or two workouts for an hour and a half, 2 days a week, right? So by doing less time, we think that that's kind of lazy. Like you're only doing 20 minutes, man, and then you're hitting the shower and heading home. What's wrong with you? But in reality, it's not. It's actually smart because the consistency is the most important part. A good example is online business or YouTube channels, right? A lot of people think they have to quit their job and start a business from scratch. And, you know, that's kind of the burn the ships mentality that Hernando Cortez, when he wanted to commit, he burned his ships and he never looked back, and that's why he won the battle. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that you can do less and you can do it more often. You'll get a better result. I think you put a ton of stress on yourself if you say, I've never done anything like this, so tomorrow I'm quitting. It'd be way smarter if you slowly build a YouTube channel over the course of 2 or 3 years. Time's the hardest thing. Time's the most valuable resource, right, that we talked about. And that's the thing that's really going to build it. Because it doesn't matter how good your content is, you need patience and you need time for it to catch on. That's really what you need. And then it grows exponentially. But you can't force it. So this is a tangent. This is a rant on how less is not lazy. You don't need to go all in 100% of the time on everything. You can allow yourself some rest and to sit back on it. Number 9, this one sounds crude, but don't shit where you eat. If you should have separate places for everything. And that psychologically is beneficial because for me, this is my bedroom and I work here. Well, sometimes it's hard for me to wind down because I'm working, filming, editing in my bedroom. And then when I come back at the end of a day, I'm like, oh, I feel like I'm at work again. So for me, I found it really beneficial to have separate places for the gym. So I don't work out at home. I work out at a gym where I go to a coffee office shop where I do all my editing. And where I relax here, and then upstairs, you know, I do some more personal stuff like meditating or reading or journaling. So having all separate places, man, that's a big jump in mental clarity than trying to have everything in one place. All right, the best lesson from this book, drum roll, is the 80-20 principle and Parkinson's law. So the 80-20 principle has gotten talked about a lot over the last 5 years. It basically comes from an economist who noticed that in his garden, 80% of his pea pods were producing only 20% of the peas. But when he looked at the other 20% of his pea pods, he he noticed they were yielding 80% of his peas. So I think his name was Pareto. He looked at the traffic. He said, this is a fascinating pattern. So he was studying traffic, and he noticed that 80% of the traffic occurred on 20% of the streets. That if you look in a business, 20% of the customers give you 80% of the profit. If you look in your closet, probably 20% of your clothes give you 80% of the wear. I know this thing, I'm wearing it in nearly every video, right? It's not always, you know, 80-20 exactly on the money. Sometimes it's 90-10, could be 60-40. So in your life, maybe 80% of your results are coming from 20% of your efforts. For example, for me, you know, with this YouTube thing, like I could just do these in one take and save probably 80% of the time with the editing and the audio and fidgeting and all that stuff. Why I don't do that, I don't know. Maybe I should start doing it. But for example, you know, if you wanted to start a YouTube channel, 20% of your input could get you 80% of the results. So how much does editing and quality and all that really matter? Might be a 20%, not an 80%. And then in the book, he goes into Parkinson's Law as well, which is a really, really cool thing that says tasks will expand to the time you allow for them. Think back to college. When were you doing your term papers, right? Thursday night before they were due on Friday at midnight. So if we give ourselves 12 hours, the task is going to take all 12 hours. So shortening the deadlines and really honing in on that 80-20, focusing on that 20% in a shorter deadline, you're able to get way, way more done. Always ask yourself, how can I make this easier? Huge tip as well. Whew. All right, that was 20 minutes. I'm not sure what it is after editing, but thanks so much for watching, guys. If you want this book, there's a link in the description below. 11 Questions Change Your Life is a free ebook I put out with the 11 best questions you can answer in your journal, when you're driving to work, in your head, wherever you want to answer them. And thousands of people have done it already. It's a great way to go more into yourself, find out more about you, and use it to join the new rich and eliminate and define definition for what you want. That's it, guys. I'll see you back here next week. We are doing, I think we're doing this one, The One Thing, The Surprising Simple Truth Behind Extraordinary Results by Gary Keller and Jay Papsin. If you missed last week's, don't miss it. We did, it's not around here, but we did The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Go back and watch that video. Until next time, leave me a comment in the description below. What was your favorite point of the 10? I want to know down there. All right, guys, thanks so much. Till next time, stop settling, start living. See you later.
Okay, today's podcast is titled Doing Business Sight Unseen. Doing Business Sight Unseen, 619-768-2945. Now, according to my clock, it is 10:55 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. And right now, I'm supposed to be boarded on a plane from Orlando, Florida, going to Chicago, Illinois. But I'm not on that plane because a contractor of sorts. I know, you know where I can't even put the label contract on. A sitter. That was supposed to do a job for me didn't show up. They showed up, but they showed up 8 hours too late, 8 hours after the fact. So I had to cancel this trip. It's the second trip I had to cancel to Chicago in about 2-3 years. But this year I've canceled. God, I've lost count. 6, 7, 8 trips. I've only been able to get out once on a long-distance trip this year. So, and that was like a 4 or 5 day trip. In any event, so I've got a math problem here because I've got business that needs to be done in far-flung places. I don't do, thank God for the internet connection because I'm able to do a lot online. but certain things had to be done, you know, on the ground. So what I'm working on here today, and a lot of people might need a solution that I'm coming up with or working out, is essentially how to do business sight unseen. Now, I've got some advantages here. Number one, I'm able to buy multiple acres of property sight unseen, legally protected. I know how to protect myself in those transactions. With the squatter that I had in my house up in the D.C. area, 2-3 years, I had to do business sight unseen because I live 1,000 miles away. So 900 to 1,000 miles away. So out of all the work that was done during that period of time, I might have been around for 0.5, but not even 1% of the work that was done. It's just send the money. I mean, do the job, send the money, or whatever arrangement we had. So essentially, and then it took a while, but it got done. Sight unseen, at least by me. So what I'm going to talk about today, because in this case, to hire a professional sitter, I'm not even going to talk about, I'm spending $600 a week now on nursing services for my mother. Okay. And if you throw in a good sitter that, because you got to look at the legal part of this too, you know, if you leave somebody in the, you know, let me paint a picture. This is what made it all clear to me last night, because I'm studying law right now, and we're on, one of the things we're studying is negligence. And I thought to myself now, because I've got cameras, I can monitor everything through my smartphone, I can open and close the doors with the smartphone, I can be in Timbuktu or Siberia, I can, you know, as long as I got an internet connection, I can basically, because this house is partially a smart house that you control with a, you know, with a smartphone. But in any event, I got to thinking, you know what, now, what if you had a 6-month-old, 12-month-old, or 24-month-old child, and you left that child in the house, and you arranged for nannies to come in twice a day in 24 hours to check on the child, feed, make sure it was fed, bathed, and all that. But they'd leave. They might be there for about a couple hours. Let's say one does 3 hours, another one does 3 hours. That's not a total of 6 hours. It's 24 hours a day. And you had the cameras, but a child being a child, or people being people, anything can happen during those other 20-plus hours in the day, 22 hours in the, you know, in the day. And then you would be charged with criminal negligence, even if nothing went wrong. You can still end up in legal hassles. So then I got to think, well, let me take some of the experiences that I've done business wise successfully sight unseen, and then let me apply it to my situation now, because I did, because it's like making some arithmetic problems, serious arithmetic problems. I figure, all right, now, if you hire, from my research, it costs about $500 a day if you're going to have one of these professionals just stay overnight and sit, okay, a live-in type situation. $500 a day. So that comes out to some very heavy money on a monthly basis, even a weekly basis. So I said, now what because I've trained my mind to think, because a lot of people say, I can't afford it. And once you start making that affirmation to yourself, I can't afford it, you paralyze your mind, your creativity. So then I thought, well, how can I afford it? In other words, here's how I think now. How many widgets do I have to make and sell? How many biscuits do I have to make and sell? Actually get somebody else to sell, because you can't make pizza and sell it too. You know, I can buy 40 acres probably quicker than the average person buys a pair of shoes. So I say, you know what? What I need to do is have people on the ground, and I do have people on the ground that I do trust to be my legs and eyes, because we have technology today. I say, well, you know, go out with your camera, do some video. Let's do a real-time chat. Listen, you go out in the field, let's do Skype in real time so I can see things. And then we can plan things on, you know, work, what type of work's going to be done, who needs to be hired, what kind of work, I mean, skilled workers that need to be hired, skilled versus unskilled. So that's what we're talking about today. How to do business sight unseen. And because I'm looking at, you know what, to be on the safe side, because, like I said, push, come, and shove, it's 50, you know, $500 a day. $500 a day times 30 days a month, that's $15,000. Now, I know if I built and sold 5 tiny houses a week, I can make that and probably have a little profit left. But I'm to the stage now at, you know what, I need to plan on building or organizing a team to build. Going back to my 9 friends audio. At least 10 houses per week. At least I've got to organize a team to do that. So, in order to organize a team, the next order we're going to play here for you with is delegation, because you can't do this stuff. I'm at a point where I cannot operate as a lone wolf. Matter of fact, the lawman's over today. I never know when the lawman's coming, but until they show up, then I got to cut a check for that. But this is the first time the lawman has brought with him an assistant. Because typically the lawman might take about 3 hours to do their work. You know, they got those lawn, sit-down lawnmowers, kind of a big lawn. And then after they finish that, they rest, and then they do the trim work. Well, today he brought an assistant, what might take this guy typically about about 2 hours and some change to do, they got it all done in about an hour. Because bought an assistant. So I figure, you know what, I'm supposed to be here right now so I can see that, because essentially that's what I'm going to have to do. Now, the money I would spend for traveling, of course, the ticket's already bought, so I can use it at another date because I got a credit on that. But, you know, the money that I would use for food, transportation, whatever you use when you're traveling, all right, that is now set aside to hire on ground people, you know, where I got to do this work. So what we're going to talk about now is delegation, because you can only take the lone wolf thing successfully to a certain point, and then you've got to organize a team you can trust where you can delegate to. So we're going to do this audio on delegation, and then there's another element after that.
I'm often asked, by people. It's one of the most asked questions I get on small businesses. How can I get my business? How can I get people where I can delegate? How do I delegate? How do I delegate? How do I delegate? How do I delegate? And really, you can't even ask that question until you've done a whole lot of preparation and you've got the right people in the right seats to delegate to. Organizations that delegate well are fanatical about a bunch of different things. Hiring and firing, to create an environment and the right kind of people in the seats to be able to delegate to. Compensation, unity, loyalty, communication, recognition. You create a culture, you create an environment inside the organization that is delegatable, that is predictable, that you can follow through on. Delegation is probably one of the most misunderstood and abused areas of leadership. We think we can delegate to someone based on their talent, and that's not it. Talent's part of it. But there's a whole process of going on with this. The process of building a team that concepts can be delegated to is lengthy. You can't just hire someone, sit them in the slot, and delegate to them. You can delegate, you know, make copies, make coffee, but I'm talking about delegating entire business systems and sections to someone. You can't do that without spending some effort and some time on this. Hiring and firing take time to find thoroughbreds and have the courage to get the donkeys out. I tried to mix thoroughbreds and donkeys for a while, and they don't like each other. Donkeys don't like thoroughbreds around because the very presence of a thoroughbred exposes a donkey's donkiness. Thoroughbreds don't like having donkeys around because, well, they're donkeys. They don't care. They're lazy. They're bullheaded. They're belligerent. And they don't care. Did I mention that they don't care? Thoroughbreds don't want to hang around that. So you get a couple talented people in a stable full of donkeys, they will leave because they don't want to hang out. Thoroughbreds don't want to hang out with donkeys. You know, when I'm doing, we do a thing called 90-day point. Once you've been with us 90 days, we all get in a room and buy Chick-fil-A wraps and Chick-fil-A whatever, and we all sit around and do Wrap with Dave, we call it. And the new people, I sit and talk with our new team members. There's, you know, 50 of them, 40 of them, whatever there is in the last 90 days. And I'm sitting with last Monday I did one of these. And they ask me questions about things. And then we ask them what their aha moment is. What's something that kind of caused you to go, wow, I didn't see that coming since you've been here? Tell me what your aha moment is. And you'd be amazed, the number of them that go, I thought, one of them the other night was a developer, and he goes, I thought I was going to kind of come in here, and this is a company that's all about financial stuff and radio and all this, and I didn't think the developers would be up to par. I figured I'd be kind of, you know, better than all of them. And he goes, it didn't take me but about 3 weeks to figure out they were all better than me. They all got me on my toes. I'm running with thoroughbreds. And the aha moment is often I get to work with smart people that care. Wow, what a cool thing. And that requires the hiring and firing process. Accidentally, sometimes you hire a donkey and you have to have a donkeyectomy then. You've done it, I've done it. I mean, you hire somebody, you thought they were right, and then you find out this was a bad idea. Compensation is a reflection of your value system. If you value thoroughbreds, plan on paying them well. I've checked the marketplace, and thoroughbreds cost more than donkeys. You do get what you pay for most of the time. Not always. There's no guarantee that just because you pay a lot, you're going to get a lot. But there's pretty much a guarantee that if you don't pay a lot, you're not going to get a thoroughbred. You're going to pay a little more to get somebody that really brings the water, that really knows what they're doing, and that really cares deeply, and that thinks critically. They think above the problem. They're not just trying to get by, and they don't say, take it easy and mean it. Thank God it's Friday. Oh, God, it's Monday. How quick can I get out of here and how late can I come? You know, right? It's a different world when you hire a thoroughbred. But they cost a little more because they have a little more expectation of you and of the organization. And they need an upward trajectory of that they can grow with the company. And as the company grows, maybe their income grows. And, you know, you got to be generous is what it amounts to. And it's great ROI, though, because you don't have to hire as many thoroughbreds to do the work as you do donkeys. People are only loyal when you're loyal to them. Creating loyalty, creating unity is a constant battle. It does not randomly occur. People are not loyal to corporate America for one simple reason. Corporate America is not loyal to people. That's what's going on. And you have the ability, particularly those of you that are leading in small businesses and owning and running small businesses, you have the ability to be different, to actually be loyal to someone. I was actually... jumped out of a plane, jumped into a car service in another state not long ago, and the guy driving the limo thing, the little black sedan thing, it wasn't a limo, but you know, the limo service, whatever you call it, the car service, he's telling me a story, driving me over. I asked him, how long have you been working? He said, I just started driving for these guys about 6 weeks ago. I used to drive for another company, and they fired me. And I went, oh, that's comforting. Well, why were you fired, pray tell? And he said, my wife and I are separated, and she lives in New Jersey. He was in a different state over in the Midwest. And he said, my daughter got kidnapped and was missing for 6 weeks. And I asked for time off to go participate with the police in the searches, and they finally found her in a park. This guy dropped her off after he had carried her around for 6 weeks. A horrible story, this young 13-year-old girl. And this company, because he took time off to go find his daughter, fired him. You know, it's just like, you did what? You know, I mean, maybe they didn't believe his story. I don't know. I mean, who does that? Companies do that. They do that all the time. They have no soul. And you have the ability to have a soul. To go, my gosh, I can't even imagine. Of course you can take time off. And I don't know how long I can not pay you. I mean, I can pay you to not work, but at least you can not be here for sure. And your job will be here when you get back. And how can we help you? And how can we, my gosh, I can't, what up with my daughter or my granddaughter? I mean, how would I, you know, you treat other people like you'd want to be treated. That's how you create loyalty. Do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. Why is that hard? Why is that hard? Communication and recognition, organizations that delegate well are overly intentional about communication, and they're generous with recognition. We over-communicate. I tell our team all the time, we have a staff meeting, all 700 of them, every Monday morning for an hour. That's an investment in payroll. That's how much we believe in communication. Because if the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing, people don't know what's going on. If people don't know what's going on inside your company, you know what they assume? They assume the worst. They assume it's bad. They automatically think there's a secret, there's a bad thing, there's a conspiracy. People never go, well, I don't know what's going on, but I'm sure it's awesome. They never do that. It's not human nature, right? And so you have to over-communicate. You have to give them too much information. Information that makes you feel a little bit uncomfortable because you went so far into the details. And you're not insulting people. We're not trying to throw people on the bus. But we tell people what's going on. You're grown-ups. This is not a kindergarten class. We're going to have an adult discussion here. Here's some stuff that went on, and here's the result of what went on. And you need to know that you're going to read this on Twitter, and you're going to see this coming, and you're going to hear this about Dave Ramsey, and here's what really did happen out of that, and here's what really didn't happen out of that. And you need to know that, because you work here, instead of wondering, well, I read the article and I don't know, I work here, but I don't know what they really did. You know, I just tell you, it's not hard. Over communicate. But a lot of people are so afraid that if people have information, that they will somehow misuse that information. Now, we don't tell people's secrets. We don't tell individuals people's stuff and shame someone or harm someone. I don't mean that kind of thing. But we, corporately, as far as information goes, we give you too much information. It's okay for them to have information. It's not going to destroy them. Lack of information will destroy them more often than too much information. But our tendency is to hold back and go, I don't know if they can handle that. What will that do to morale? Well, I'll tell you what it'll do to morale. It'll destroy it if you don't tell them what's going on. That's what it'll do. You create an environment that's not delegatable because they don't trust. A lot of companies use mushroom communication. Keep everybody in the dark and feed them manure. You got to use real communication. In order for a leader to completely delegate, they have to come to trust the team members' integrity and their competency. Circle that, put stars around it. That is the thesis statement of this lesson. That is how you delegate right there. When you can trust someone's integrity and you can trust their ability to do what you're asking them to do, you don't have to check it. You'll just check the results. You don't have to micromanage anymore. And that takes time. You cannot hire someone off the street and in 6 seconds go, I trust your integrity and I trust your competency now that you just got past your resume. No way. Not unless you're a fool. And the more time you spend with someone and the more you see them accomplishing it, the more you can trust their integrity, right? The more you can trust their competency. So someone that has been with me for 20 years and is running a $50 million section of our business, one of our EVPs is an example, obviously I have a lot more trust in that lady or that man's integrity and in their competency than I do a new leader who just started with us 6 weeks ago. There's no possible way. I don't have a track record with them. I don't trust them based on their resume or what they did at the other place. They get a shot at me trusting them based on what they did at the other place. But they earn the trust here. They earn the comp. They prove their competence here.
Now, that was on delegation. He didn't mention anything about contracts, but you need to have a set of instructions. And I'm speaking in terms of, you know, not, you know, employer to employee, but contractors or general contractor to contractor when you're doing business sight unseen locally or at a distance. You need to have a contract and written instructions. Just don't send the money. Sometimes when you just send the money with nothing in writing, because trust really should, in my opinion, should be reduced down to paper. Put it in writing. But some people, if you've been dealing with somebody for a period of time, or maybe your back's up against the wall, you send money, you don't have anything in writing, and sometimes the job might get done to your desired result. However, a lot of times when you do something like that and it's not in writing, even if you're local and face-to-face, that job might not get done. Or if you send out money in advance, and I'm talking about a considerable amount of money, for whatever the contract is, they might not do the job, or they might not do the job correct, or a gazillion things all in between. So what I recommend is, one of the things I recommend is get familiar with escrow. I'm going to play this audio on escrow. It's going to come from a real estate point of view, but essentially you can set up an escrow, which is a third-party payment system or agent, to basically have with escrow instructions that, okay, if this money sits here when these particular tasks has been done, you have a checks and balance system, and then after the escrow agent sees that A, B, and C have been done, they'll release a portion of the funds, whatever the escrow instructions call for. So let's play this thing on escrow is geared towards real estate people, but fundamentally you can apply this to any type of business transaction.
Hi, I'm Corey Schwab. I'm a senior escrow officer with Mara Escrow in Beverly Hills, and I have been handling escrow transactions for over 25 years.
Great. What is escrow?
What is escrow? Escrow is the real estate transaction between a buyer and seller. We handle it as a neutral third party, and it comes to us after a buyer and seller have come to an agreement and have a purchase contract, typically with their real estate agents. They've put the deal together, and it comes to us to handle the transaction during that 30 or 60 day period.
Okay, great. And can you walk me through a typical escrow?
Yes. The escrow opens with the real estate purchase contract coming to us. We then prepare the escrow instructions and any of the escrow papers that will need to be prepared throughout that period. But at the beginning, we will order any of the reports that are necessary, such as the property disclosure report. And importantly, we open the title search with a title company so that they can search the property to make sure that it's free and clear of liens and encumbrances. And they'll give a report that will then be forwarded to the buyer for their approval.
What are the benefits of, for a buyer or seller to use escrow?
Typically, I think the biggest benefit would be that we are the neutral third party. We are there not to be representing either one of them, but to be fair to both of them And so any agreement that is made during the escrow period with their real estate agents will then come to us as that neutral third party. That's something that's already been mutually agreed to, and we will continue that process. And then during the process, we work with the buyer's new lender. We work to make sure that all the liens and encumbrances are paid off, such as the existing loans, and make sure that all of the reports and paperwork documentation that need to be transferred between the buyer and seller are ordered and acknowledged.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. And what are the fees typically involved for both the buyer and seller?
Typically, the seller is paying the commission,
mm-hmm.
and the seller in Southern California will normally pay the documentary transfer tax, and the seller typically here in Southern California pays for the seller's or the owner's title policy, and the buyer will typically pay if they have a new loan for their lender's title policy. They both share the escrow fees. They both pay the same amount and their costs and charges associated with the escrow. And then the seller, if there's a condominium, they'll pay for their homeowner's transfer fees and documentation. We do all the prorations of homeowner's fees and property taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And then any of the reports, again, the property disclosure report, any termite work and inspection fees, home protection plans, mm-hmm. and such.
Who chooses an escrow company?
The escrow company is typically chosen by the real estate agents. It is who we have relationships with, and fortunately, I have known Michael Collins for over 20 years, and we have had that relationship. If the buyer and seller have a relationship with an escrow company, that also might come into play if they are in the real estate field in one way or another, and they have a relationship. And then otherwise it's normally the real estate agents.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so when paying people at a distance, I would recommend setting up, number one, having a contract. All right, don't rush into this stuff. Have a contract. So have something in writing. Organize an escrow account, and then in that, with that escrow account, you have instructions on when the money to be released based on evidence that actual work has been done. And you might want to have a floating third party, well, maybe fourth party, that inspects the work to make sure it's done. That way you actually, everybody is protected. Everybody's protected. Just some thoughts on doing business sight unseen. Some people, you know, they don't, well, some people, well, a lot of people actually do it. And some people have to transition to do it on a regular basis. That's the stage I'm at right now. I've got to do it. I've got to master the art and science of doing business sight unseen at a distance. So I've done it before in the past, but now I've got to amp it up to about, well, I'll put it in terms of houses, about minimum 30 a month. 30 a month I have to do. So we'll keep you posted on that. That's about it. On this end of the day, like I said, I'm supposed to be in the air right now, but I'm here talking to you guys. So that's, I guess, talking about how to do business sight unseen. So on that note, Jesus. That's it for today. Everyone have a good rest of the day.